Before there were cell phones and satellite phones, GPS and other global positioning gizmos, you could get lost in the wilderness or be in danger and have to depend on your physical and mental skills to, in a sense, rescue yourself. Today, technology plays an increasing role in outdoor adventure, allowing the public to explore the wilderness and changing the experience of being alone in the wild. Some longtime mountaineers are mourning the good old days when venturing into the wild really was an escape from it all. Well, today on Radio Times, we want to talk about modern-day adventuring technology and the drive that pushes and pulls people into the great outdoors. We have two guests who have joined us for this hour on Radio Times. Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Paul Deegan. He's an explorer and an expedition leader, and it's nice to have you with us on Radio Times, Paul.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there. And on the telephone is David Roberts, a longtime climber, the author of a number of books. He's got a new one called Finding Everett Ruiz, The Life and Unsolved Disappearance of a Legendary Wilderness Explorer. He also wrote an article in the New York Times recently that was titled Exploits Now Not So Daring. And David Roberts, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, I'm curious about the response to your article. You write, the dictum of adventure that has been true for centuries may not hold anymore, that if you get into trouble, you have to get yourself out, and that communication technology is really changing adventure for the worse. How so?
Well, I think when I started climbing in the 1960s, we certainly never expected anybody to come rescue us if we got in trouble. And I just don't think that's true anymore, at least in mountain climbing. In fact, at its worst, there are people calling for rescues when they're just sort of uncomfortable. And one of the tragedies I cited in my Times op-ed piece was a helicopter rescue near Everest on Ahmad Devlam. And I've been told since that the two guys who called for the rescue really just could have down-climbed the mountain. Instead, the chopper caught a rotor on the slope and killed both the pilot and the engineer.
Wow, which is, of course, is deeply tragic. But are you concerned that this technology is putting rescuers in danger, but also allowing people that shouldn't be up on mountains to go up on mountains, thinking that they can get rescued?
Yes, and of course, this sounds like an old curmudgeon speaking.
That's
there's
okay.
Always that danger.
Yes,
but,
indeed.
But I also think it there's an aesthetic loss here in that. It just being so connected to the outside world. I mean, more and more expeditions are going off with online dispatches sent every day and school kids watching in and vast publics watching your every move. And I think that makes the act of exploring too self-conscious and too even media-driven rather than for its own sake.
In fact, you write about the, quote, blissful disconnectedness from the rest of the world. I know you just got back from Utah. Did you feel blissfully disconnected from us?
Well, Utah's not Alaska.
No, it isn't.
But, you know, hiking in a canyon all by yourself, just even for a day, is that does give you the taste of that disconnectedness. I cited it in a kind of obituary for Walter Bonatti, the great Italian climber who died 2 weeks ago. Because he was really the exemplar of embracing disconnectedness, doing it on his own, and loving the fact that he was completely resourceful, self-resourceful. And same thing with the book I've just written, Finding Everett Ruiz. This is a kid who in the 1930s, and I mean kid because he was 20 when he disappeared, just went out with a couple of burros and did these marathon, several-month, 10-month, in one case, journeys through the Southwest solo. He certainly didn't. He was out there. He didn't expect anybody to come get him if he got in trouble.
Well, let me get Paul Deegan in on the conversation. Paul, you've been listening in as David Roberts has been talking about his curmudgeonly rant, I guess. But how do you view, I guess, the fact that technology can keep us connected, but it also can disconnect us from this experience of the wild?
I think David will be pleased to hear I'm probably a curmudgeon as well to a degree. I think it's trying to find this balance. I mean, I've been lucky enough in the last 20 years to do expeditions where we have had technology, and I think we've used it wisely. But we've also done expeditions where we've deliberately chosen not to take any technology, any form of communication at all. So I think even today, modern expeditioners, adventurers, explorers, climbers, have the choice, didn't have the choice maybe 30 years ago, but you've got the choice today. And there's a lot of power in that choice, and it's making that choice wisely that's really important.
But you, both of you, are experienced explorers, climbers, and I'm assuming, in fact, you were telling me, Paul, before we went on the air, that you would want to make sure that you had exhausted every option that you had before you made a phone call to get rescued.
Yeah, I mean, like David, you know, I've had trips where people, not everyone's come home, but I think the advantage of having some kind of satellite communication technology is not to come to rely on it, but that if something very bad happens, that you have that as an option. Now, the option might be irrelevant because the weather might be bad, so a helicopter can't come and get you, so nothing's going to improve, or it's a sudden equipment failure and the person perishes immediately, so helicopter rescue wouldn't have made a difference. But I do want to carry that equipment with me most of the time, so that if something went wrong and someone didn't come home, I could look the parents or the wife or the kids in the eye when I got home and said, we really did do everything we could. And I think that's really important.
Well, and you're responsible for other people that you are taking out on an expedition.
Sure, I'm not a guide, so I don't get paid to take people, but I do enjoy organising expeditions and inviting friends on them, and I do take that position of expedition leader very seriously.
Have there been times, or was there a time you had to call for a rescue for yourself?
I'm lucky in that whenever I've had something go wrong for me, I've always managed to extract myself. So, no. And on the occasions where somebody hasn't come home from the expedition, one example, they had a heart attack. I mean, they were dead in 5 minutes, so it was kind of irrelevant. No. I've been on expeditions such as the Everest disaster in '96, where, you know, 11 people died during that trip. And even on that expedition, most famously, when Rob Hall was patched through from a radio to a sat phone to his wife in New Zealand, talked about the naming of their child before he passed away. Again, you know, all the technology in the world wasn't going to save Rob Hall.
To you, David Roberts, but do you see this technology, and I'm hearing from both of you, but certainly from Paul Deegan, which is for experienced people, that they have that option, but because they're experienced, they may not misuse this technology and still know how to have that kind of experience in the wild.
Well, I fully respect what Paul's saying and admire his ethic of exhausting every possible resource before you call for help. And, of course, we can't wish that people in trouble not have the option to get rescued. But I think if you put in this historical perspective, what even my generation did pales in comparison to, say, 19th century journeys in search of the Northwest Passage, where ships would be out of contact with England for 3 years, getting frozen in the ice, mm-hmm. with no possible communication. And those explorers seem to accept that kind of deprivation the way I think none of us today could handle it psychologically.
Are people getting softer, you think, then?
Well, I think everything is faster, and you know, I get that very few of us would commit 3 years to an expedition anymore. Do you agree, Paul?
Well, he's nodding your head.
Yeah,
yes,
I think you're right, David. I think probably for me the epitome of modern expeditions, and by modern I mean, I guess, you know, in the 70s or 80s or 90s, away from climbing, was Roger Meir and Robert Swan's expedition in the footsteps of Scott in the mid-1980s. So they bought a boat, sailed to Antarctica, overwintered, then set out for the South Pole without radio communications. And I think that's the closest that anyone's attempted to come to recreating that feeling of being isolated and cut off and totally self-sufficient in the way that 19th and early 20th century explorers were.
David, I'm curious, do you use a cell phone when you're, you know, back home?
Yes, but I don't take it with me when I'm hiking.
And you don't miss it? I mean, I'm not a experienced explorer as both of you are, but I can also imagine wanting to share something that I've seen with someone back home. You don't feel that?
I've done a couple of expeditions where I was asked to write online dispatches while we were in the middle of Ethiopia or New Guinea or Argentina, and it's deeply unsettling for me, even though I kind of got into it. I love the sort of manic pace of it, but there's something very weird about reporting your deeds at the very moment that they're happening. I think Paul's sighting of Mears and Swan's expedition is a perfect example of choosing to do without and insisting on a very old-fashioned kind of self-sufficiency that is incredibly rare anymore. And that was an extraordinary expedition they pulled off.
But, and I'll put this to you, Paul, but I'm also thinking, I mean, the gear that people use to climb mountains much more sophisticated than it used to be. Is technology any different from that, do you think?
In terms of the actual improvements in that technology?
Exactly.
I mean, it's all getting lighter. It's all getting more manageable. I remember that when I first went to Everest in 1988, when I co-led a cleanup when I was 18, there were no telephones in the Khumbu Valley, the valley approaching Everest, and it took 6 hours to place a call from the capital of Nepal, Kathmandu, back to London. And you fast forward 5 years, we went back in 93, and the joint expedition leader of that expedition wanted to take a satellite phone. It was the size of a piece of a suitcase you'd carry on, you know, going on holiday somewhere. And then when I went back many years later to try and climb Everest again in 2004, the phone you could put it in your pocket. So it's extraordinary over my expedition life how that technology has shrunk and become more reliable.
And you think about the first ascent of Everest in 1953, when the only way to get word out was James Morris sending a runner and managed to time it. The scoop of the Times of London to coincide with the coronation of Elizabeth II.
But I'm wondering, I mean, whether you like it or not, David Roberts, we're all so interconnected, which is that you may not be reporting from where you are, but someone else may be doing it for you, if you know what I mean.
Well, yes, but I think the public who aren't themselves explorers make ridiculous assumptions. For instance, when Aaron Ralston, the kid who cut off his arm when he got stuck in the Slot Canyon and wrote the famous book that became 127 Hours, the movie.
Yes.
Lots of people at the time said if he'd only carried a cell phone, he wouldn't have lost his arm. Well, we know that a cell phone in the Slot Canyon is useless. You know, you just can't get a signal. So the assumption that a cell phone is going to automatic or a sat phone is going to make you foolproof or safe or you can get out of any pickle you might get into has corrupted the public's understanding of exploration, I think.
Well, we are talking about technology, the increasingly bigger role that it's playing in outdoor adventures. The voice you just heard is David Roberts. He's been a climber for much of his life. He's written a number of books. He's got a new one called Finding Everett Ruiz and wrote an article in the New York Times recently titled Exploits Now Not So Daring. Also with us is Paul Deegan. He's an explorer and expedition leader. Both of them joining us today on Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break, and we've got waiting in the wings John Leonard, and he'll be joining us from Denali National Park in Alaska. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Greater Wildwood Chamber of Commerce supports WHYY and presents the Greater Wildwood Fabulous 50s Weekend, October 14th and 15th. Highlights include a Friday night dance party featuring Jerry Blavitt and a live concert featuring five 50s acts, with the headliner being Little Anthony and the Imperials. Also on Saturday is a street fair open to the public with live music and vendors. For tickets and information, gwcoc.org.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital supports WHYY. The Kimmel Cancer Center at Jefferson is a National Cancer Institute designated center and is dedicated to providing comprehensive and coordinated multidisciplinary breast care in a compassionate and supportive environment. Breast care services are tailored to fit individual patient needs and are arranged by personal breast care coordinators. To schedule an appointment or for details, 1-800-JEFF-NOW or jeffersonhospital.org.
MacArthur Theater Center in Princeton supports WHYY and presents Phaedra Backwards, a new work by Irish playwright Marina Carr, October 18th through November 6th. The mythic and the modern collide in a lyrical new adaptation of the classic Phaedra myth that explores the pull of fate, the labyrinth of legacy, and the danger of desire. Contains adult themes. Tickets at 609-258-2787 or at MacArthur.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Not so long ago, before there were satellite phones and GPS, you could go into the wilderness, and if you got in trouble, you had to figure out how to get yourself out of trouble. Well, today, technology is playing an increasingly large role in outdoor adventures, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We asked John Leonard to join us. He's the chief climbing ranger for Denali National Park. That's in Alaska. It is a 6 million acre park with the highest mountain in North America, Mount McKinley. And John Leonard, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, hey, good morning from Talkeetna, Alaska.
Well, you sound loud and clear, which is fabulous. What does a chief climbing ranger do?
Well, part of my responsibilities are managing the mountaineering program here on Mount McKinley and other peaks inside Denali National Park and Preserve.
And you have been part of a search and rescue team?
Yeah, going back, I started in organized search and rescue in the late 80s, and it's carried through and turned into a profession today.
Do you see more people, though, taking risks in the park and taking risks because they feel that people like you are going to rescue them if they get in trouble?
I think it's fair to say that there's a false sense of security, especially considering the topic you guys are discussing today, with people's access to communication devices that make rescue seem more of a possibility.
I was reading actually about a woman from Croatia. This was earlier this year. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what happened with her, John Leonard, and why this is, I guess, a cautionary tale.
Well, the story with her was she had relatively minor injuries to, some would probably term it as slight discomfort. She essentially gave up and expected to be rescued from about 14,000 feet on Mount McKinley.
And was anything wrong with her besides the fact that perhaps she was feeling some degree of anxiousness?
She was evaluated by a couple of different physicians, and they were unable to find anything wrong with her. She had a chief complaint of some pain in one of the arches in her feet.
Now, are you required to rescue people? Let's say they're in Denali or even on Mount McKinley. Are you required to rescue them if they get in trouble?
You know, we're not required. However, in a case like the individual we're discussing, they had a satellite phone with them, and using that satellite phone, in a pretty short time frame, they were able to contact family members back in their home country, who then contacted their ambassadors here in the United States, and it wasn't too long before my phone was ringing and asking why we weren't going up to rescue this person.
So you felt pressure to rescue her?
You know, the pressure is in any time somebody's asking for help, you have to evaluate the risk of the people that are going to help. So the pressure's one side of it. With her in particular, the reason why we ended up acting was because she became such a drain of resources, and it was essentially who was going to blink first. And our choice became just to let her sit up there for some extended period of time, and the situation would have got worse. We tried for, about 7 days to get her to help herself, and she refused, and essentially it became a big mess. But.
Yes, no, I read about it, and it sounds like a big mess, and it sounded like one that I guess tested the philosophy of rescue. Was she fined? What was I guess the punishment so-called for this climber?
She was cited, a minimal fine. We were pretty limited in what we can do in cases like that. Unfortunately, sometimes we're not able to say no because of outside influences, and frankly, people's expectations have changed to where they feel that they can travel into a pretty remote wilderness, and help's only a phone call away.
But I think what people don't understand, and I would include myself because I'm not a climber, but the risks of rescuing someone for the rescue team.
They are, and you know, those are real things. I'd hope that we conduct, you know, our operations in the safest possible manner, but there's always an inherent risk to going into the mountains, into wild places, whether you're taking part in a rescue or some personal exploration.
And would you say that the rescue, the safety teams, that their safety is the top priority?
Absolutely. That's first and foremost in any incident manager's mind. And then, you know, it proceeds from there.
Right. Let me get
John,
yeah,
John,
go ahead, David Roberts. Yes.
It's David Roberts.
Yes, go ahead.
Jim Tabor's book about the Wilcox disaster on Denali in 1967 faulted the Park Service for not rescuing those seven guys who died. And I thought that was completely erroneous. In 67, there was no way of saving those guys. And Tabor, who was not a climber, misunderstood that and blamed you guys, not you personally, but the whole Park Service, for not mounting a rescue that in 67 was simply impossible. Do you agree with that,
John?
I do. There are so many variables, especially when you talk about going up high on a mountain such as Mount McKinley or any other high peak, and the thought that it's just something that can go out and be done is one that sometimes is difficult to overcome.
And John, when people want to climb Mount McKinley, do you give them pointers, advice? Are there classes before people take off on this mountain?
You know, we one of our big efforts here is what is now referred to as PSAR, preventative search and rescue, and essentially that's a fair amount of upfront education. So hopefully when people come here, their eyes are wide open and they understand what's in front of them. However, that's not always the case, and at times we're surprised with people's lack of preparation.
And Mount McKinley is, as I said, the highest mountain in North America. How many people have died climbing that mountain this year?
We had, in the park this year, we had 9 fatalities. Wow. On Mount McKinley, we had 6.
And were these inexperienced people, experienced people? Do you know what happened?
There was a range. We had some very experienced climbers that that died, and some ones that were more beginners.
Any advice, a final question, any advice to our listeners before we say goodbye, John?
You know, I would say that there's no amount of technology that'll overcome bad decision making. And a mentor of mine has always said the lightest thing to carry with you is knowledge and experience.
Well, let me just give Paul Deegan a chance to respond, because he nodded enthusiastically, John, when you said that. Paul, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think what John said is absolutely true. And I just wonder, though, that I've been to Denali. It's an amazing park. It's an amazing mountain, and the rangers do an incredible job. But if all that was stripped away and Denali was like a Himalayan peak where there's no rescue service, I guess the numbers of people would rapidly decline, and there'd be a brief spike perhaps in fatalities, and then less people would go. And It's a difficult decision. I'm sure it's one that the Park Service wrestles with every year.
Yeah, because you want people to come, right?
Absolutely, and we hope that people are coming, and we're not influencing their decision making process. But the reality is, whether it's technology or a Park Service presence, there's an influence that, unfortunately, at times changes people's personal risk analysis.
And I would think books can do that as well, right? John Leonard, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
All right, well, take care.
You too. And he's the chief climbing ranger for Denali National Park. That's in Alaska, a 6-million-acre park. The highest mountain in North America is there, Mount McKinley. We will continue our conversation talking about adventure and technology, but I do want to talk with both of my guests in more detail about some of the adventures that they have had. Paul Deegan with us here in our Philadelphia studios. He's an explorer and an expedition leader. In fact, in a couple of months, he'll be leading a small expedition across a frozen lake in Siberia. David Roberts, a longtime mountaineer climber, the author of a number of books, including a new one called Finding Everett Ruiz. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Paige from San Francisco to join us, and then I do want to talk about some of your experiences and how both of you got into exploration and adventuring. First, we have Paige from San Francisco joining us. And Paige, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. I have a friend who works for Search and Rescue in Southeast Utah. And they had received a phone call one night from a gentleman who was lost in one of the national parks. And as they were trying to get him to describe at all where he was, the best he could say was, "I'm here under the Big Dipper."
Well, yes.
It's rather unfortunate that, you know, people think that somehow having a cell phone is, and being able to call is going to make them, you know, he really probably had no business being out there at night if he could see the Big Dipper. Some of these folks really don't have any business being out there anyway.
Well, Paige, I appreciate that.
I appreciate the people, you know, the folks who are professionals needing it as kind of a last resort and understanding the inherent dangers that are out there. But for a lot of the general public, you know, technology in the wrong hands can be a ticket to their own demise.
Well, that's exactly what we're talking about, Paige, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And David Roberts, you just got back from Utah. I heard you laugh, but, I'm not sure how much the rescue team were laughing when they got that phone call. But this really underscores what we're talking about.
Well, it's also, to shift the ground a little bit, I think another new phenomenon is the fact that explorers are making careers out of reporting their exploits to a huge public back home. And I think for people like Paul and me, when we started out, we did it because we just wanted to climb the mountain. We didn't think of it as a career with sponsorship and celebrity and especially on live in real-time coverage of our adventures. And I can't help being the curmudgeon. I can't help thinking that too corrupts the experience, or at least dilutes it.
Well, let me give you a chance to weigh in on that, Paul. Go ahead.
I think to a degree that's true, but I also think that throughout the history of exploration, there have always been people who have tried to maximize the amount of publicity in order to get sponsorship, in order to go and do it. I mean, Sir Ernest Shackleton is a classic example of a self-made man who went on the road, did lecture tours, wrote books, and realized the value of photography and films. It's true, of course, he couldn't report directly from the field. But, you know, his ships were equipped with radios when the Aurora, which was his support team vessel for his ill-fated crossing of Antarctica in 1914, got into difficulties. They did try to use the radio and made extremely brief and unsuccessful contact with a radio operator in New Zealand. So there are explorers who have earned their living this way, and it's not a new phenomenon, but I think the technology allows more people to try their hand at it.
But do you think it dilutes the experience, or it's just another way of exploring the wilderness?
Yeah, no, I mean, it did. We did an expedition to some previously unclimbed mountains in Central Asia at the turn of this century, and we did have a satellite phone. We had an obligation to a sponsor without whom we couldn't have gone, and we did do interviews and radio conversations with people back in the UK. And on one level, it absolutely diluted the experience. On the other level, it was a privilege to know that we were sharing our story. And I did a quick computation before coming here today. Mm-hmm. We would have had to have given, I think, 400 lectures at the Kimmel Center here in Philadelphia to equal the number of people who we managed to share our story with. And maybe our story about those unclimbed peaks encouraged people to think differently about the world and what's still out there to do. And if some of those people decided to go for a walk in, you know, Valley Forge National Park or the Appalachian Trail for a couple of days, they can turn off their cell phone and have that undiluted experience. And the undiluted experience is still something I often do on expeditions.
I'd be curious your response, David Roberts.
That's fair enough, Paul. I'm actually writing a book about Douglas Mawson right now, who was the first explorer to try to use radio contact from Antarctica. And yes, to fund an expedition, Shackleton and Scott had to hustle all the sponsors they could shake a stick at. So you're right. I stand corrected. There's always been the publicity machine. I guess it's the immediacy, the real-time part of it that bothers me. And I think the example of Tomas Humar becoming a Slovenian hero for getting rescued from Nanga Parbat is the kind of thing that sticks in my craw.
Well, Paul and I were talking, David, before the show went on the air, and he was saying, you know, to be rescued is to fail. Is that how you see it?
Yes.
And that's how you see it, Paul?
Yes, I mean, it's a failure I'm willing to suffer. I'd rather fail and get rescued than fail and not come home. More importantly, I'm happy to fail, especially if it means a team member of mine can come home. But I do think back on all the experiences I've had where there have been near misses. And I have to say that having a cell phone, having a satellite phone, having a means to communicate would have made absolutely no difference to my survival. I survived either through fate or chance or because on one particular incident when a friend of mine risked his life to save mine. And
what happened?
Oh, we were in a Himalayan kingdom called Zanskar in the Indian Himalaya. And the only way in and out in winter is to follow a frozen river down a gorge that's in places deeper than America's Grand Canyon. It's an amazing experience. And the most beautiful place I think I've ever been. But unfortunately, on one day, we took every precaution to cross the frozen river in the right places. We had a local guide. The ice broke from under me after the rest of the team had crossed the river. Mm-hmm. And most of them had gone around the corner, apart from one friend of mine, Seb. And luckily, I managed to shout out to him after I'd been in the river a couple of minutes trying to get myself out, with the ice breaking again and again each time I tried to get out. And he heard me, came back, and dropped his rucksack, crawled out on the ice and pulled me out.
Wow.
And the only thing I hope is that one day I can return the favor either to Seb or to someone else.
Well, and that tells us something, David Roberts, about the connection that adventurers, explorers have with each other.
Exactly. I mean, I think the greatest benefit of exploring is friendship, is brotherhood, is the fact that you're putting your life in someone else's hands and trusting him to make or her to make all the crucial decisions. You don't do that very often in quote-unquote real life.
I like that quote-unquote. We're almost up in a break here, but David, do you go out by yourself when you're out adventuring, or do you go with others?
Both. I mean, what I'm doing now is not nearly as serious as the climbing I did when I was younger, but I was, by the age of 22, involved in three fatal accidents with friends and partners that took four lives, and I've wondered ever since why I kept climbing. I think most people would have quit. In fact, I wrote a whole climbing memoir trying to explain why I didn't quit.
Yeah. Well,
and I think the point is you've got to accept that risk is always part of the game.
And that's David Roberts, who joins us along with Paul Deegan. They are both explorers and climbers and adventurers. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We're going to talk more about how they got into this after a very short break.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY and presents an exhibition with an original live theater performance, Fighting for Democracy, Who is the We in We the People? The real-life struggles and triumphs of seven diverse citizens who fought for freedom and justice during World War II. Compelling stories come to life from ordinary people with extraordinary legacies. At the National Constitution Center, October 14th through January 16th. Tickets at constitutioncenter.org.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's daytime news magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, Here and Now. Today at noon on WHYY.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. 1812 Productions presents Mistakes Were Made, the newest comedy from Craig Wright, writer for 6 Feet Under and United States of Terra. Starring Barrymore Award winner Scott Greer, this fast-paced comedy shows us an afternoon in the life of a Broadway producer who turns the theater world on its ear when he decides to make art instead of money. Mistakes Were Made, now on stage through October 30th. Tickets at 1812productions.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about modern-day adventuring and the drive that pushes people into the void. Our guests are Paul Deegan and David Roberts, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And David, if I can just pick up on what you were saying right before our break, and how old were you, I guess, when you first started mountain climbing?
I started at 17 and in high school in Colorado, and only 5 months after I began climbing, my best friend and partner was killed on a fall on the Flatirons above Boulder.
Wow.
And it was I almost quit right then, but for reasons I'm still trying to sort out, I've kept climbing, even though I had those two other accidents by the time I was 22. But not to dwell on my own experience so much as to reinforce the point that I think part of the problem of connectedness is the illusion, and Paul, you touched on this earlier, that technology can get you out of trouble, whereas at the best, technology is only a shortcut, and self-reliance and skill and knowledge are so much more important, and risk is always an inevitable part of exploring.
Well, and I know that because you've written about the fact that you lost several friends early on in your climbing career, if I can use that word. Were they experienced climbers? Did they just make a mistake, or this is just what happens when you're out in potentially dangerous places?
Well, my high school friend and I were novices, and we screwed up, but in a very complicated way. Mm. The other three guys who were killed were relatively experienced, and in accidents that could happen to anybody, in one case possibly getting avalanched out of an ice gully, in another case on an Alaskan expedition when our partner Ed Burned, something failed with the rappel in the middle of the night, and he simply fell 4,500 feet to his death.
Oh, goodness.
I still don't know what happened, but over the course of a 40-day expedition, you make so many decisions. How to pound a piton, where, how to get on rappel. But all it takes is one mistake or even one just bad luck, piece of bad luck, and it's all over.
I have to say I'm very moved that you still don't know why. I mean, you've been doing this for a long time, but you still don't know exactly why. Did I hear you right?
Yeah. I mean, as I said, I wrote a book trying to explain it.
Right.
But I think there is a certain selfishness in exploring, and part of why I kept doing it was that I managed to cauterize myself against the grief that it caused the families of the friends who were killed. Really became kind of numb to it, and looking back now in my 60s, I'm ashamed of that.
Wow. Let me get you back in on the conversation, Paul, because you also were, I guess, about David's age when
yep.
you became a... What are you, an explorer?
Well, that's when climber? I started. Yeah, that's when I started climbing. You know, that's when I really started getting involved in it. And I'm kind of relieved to hear that David's still struggling to work out why he does it, because I can't work it out. And I thought I should have solved it by now. So, if David hasn't solved it after 20 books, I'm feeling a bit better about my own inability to work it out. But and David is right. It is an inherently selfish thing to do. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean, you know, you're spending a lot of time, it's your own money, but you're spending a lot of time, you're going away, and, you know, responsibilities at home get put on hold. But I also think that, as well as the friendship aspect that David talked about, and that for me is the number one reason why I do expeditions with friends rather than solo expeditions, which friends of mine do, is it gives you that time away, disconnected, as David said. Even for myself, taking a satellite phone, largely disconnected, it gives you the time to reflect on your life back home for an extended period of time, weeks or months. And the beauty of that is, I think for me, that when I come home, I've become less selfish and I've become more grateful for the things that we all, including me, take for granted when we're back in the real world. And so, although it's a selfish act, it somehow becomes less selfish by the end of the experience.
Can you relate to that, David?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. I'm not sure it's so true for me, but I may be made differently from Paul, and I think that's wonderful if that's what happens. I do agree that to be out there in the wilderness gives you a profound chance to meditate, to reflect, to think about the stuff that you're too busy to think about when you're running around doing your daily chores or your job.
Paul, if I can just ask you one question, then I do want to get to our callers, or back to our callers, I should say, because you had, I guess, life and death introduction to the world of being an explorer and expedition leader.
Yeah, ironically, I'd actually gone in a car to go and do some parasending, which is this ridiculous thing I actually never ended up doing, where you get towed behind a vehicle down a runway with a parachute, so you go airborne for 30 seconds. Anyway, it was cancelled because the weather was terrible. And on the way home, we had a terrible car crash, and I went out the back windscreen of the car at 80 miles an hour, flew 40 feet through the air. And when I was in hospital, obviously, that night, the policeman came up to my bedside and said, just told me bluntly that, statistically speaking, I should have died. And that had the effect not of me trying to take less risks, nor trying to seek out deliberately to take more risks, but to expose myself to as many experiences in life as I could, because I realized I got a second chance. Mm. And I guess the way that I expressed myself was by going climbing.
Well, and David, this, I mean, it's almost a cliche to talk this way, but I mean, this, we're talking about life and death here, are we not?
Yeah.
In its most kind of stark terms, which is you put yourself into some kind of danger, and for the experience of feeling one sense of survival, being alive, testing yourself.
I would have to say the happiest moments of my life have been on mountains. And especially on summits, when you spend days or weeks not knowing whether you're going to make it to the top, and then you finally do. I mean, you literally scream out loud with joy. And I never feel that when I write a book, for instance.
When you're out, do you miss things, or are you happier out in the wild, David?
I don't miss anything. I mean, I miss finding out what's happening to the Red Sox.
Sorry about that. Well, we have our own troubles down here with our own sports teams as well. So that is that true? That's the only thing you miss? Are the Red Sox games or scores?
Pretty much.
A true New Englander, I can tell. Let me get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Joshua from San Francisco joining us on Radio Times. Joshua, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
I had a comment about the dispatches from the field. I used to work for a company in California back in 1999-2000 called Quokka Sports, and we did live broadcast of adventure sports. And what we would do is we would outfit adventurers with cameras and radios and all these things, and they would go out and they would do these expeditions, and people would be able to follow their adventures online. And the expeditions were pretty bold. We went to the Chinese Karakoram Range. We did Great Chirango Tower. Mm-hmm. We became known for sailing races, and we did the Whitbread Race as well as Around Alone. And the comment I just wanted to make is that, you know, like most people, and I put myself in this group, I will never go climb Everest. I will never do a marathon across the Moroccan desert. And while I can appreciate adventurers who do go out for the moment of peace that they find, for the rest of us, we will never do that. And there's something very wonderful about being able to experience that with them and see these experiences that they're having and share that with them. And at the same time, too, appreciate how difficult it is. I mean, to have these dispatches come back live and to know the danger these people are in certainly helps me and helped our audience appreciate the effort that it took for these adventurers to take on these expeditions.
Well, Joshua, I appreciate that phone call. Let me just toss it first to Paul Deegan and then to David Roberts.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Joshua said is absolutely true. And there's the public back home. There's the ability for students to connect and learn more about the world from their classrooms and get them interested in the outdoors and geography and all those subjects. And I think for the adventurers who got involved with Quokka Sports that Joshua was involved with, and others now, of course, other different companies, I think those adventurers know that they're going on that expedition and their primary role is to communicate what mm-hmm. they're doing. And I would suspect from the adventurers I know that those who've done that accept that on certain trips they're going to do that, they're getting sponsorship to communicate that experience. But those same adventurers will also be going off to do their own private, quiet, smaller trips that they may or may not choose to talk about at all. And if they do choose to talk about it, it may be still through the more traditional, conventional, mm-hmm. analog means like lecturing and book writing afterwards.
What do you think, David Roberts?
I half agree. The half that doesn't agree is I think that the vicarious following of an expedition can actually cause people who might become explorers not to become. And schools like Outward Bound may divert people who could become true explorers into becoming sort of passive clients. Some people asked me if Everett Ruiz would have joined Outward Bound if it had existed in the 1930s, and it's absolutely inconceivable. It was anathema to him. He needed to do it on his own.
Yeah, and I understand that, but I also understand what Joshua was saying, because like him, I am not going to climb Everest. I'm not going to climb Mount McKinley. There are many things I'm not going to do, but for me to experience someone else's experience of that is something that I frankly want, David Roberts.
And you don't get that from reading Scott's diary 2 years later after he's died, going to the South Pole. I mean, there was a huge identification with Scott as a great British hero, but it wasn't in real time. And
no.
I think it was all the more poignant for the fact that his diary was discovered 7 months after he died and published a year after that.
And we do live in this very visual world. I mean, people's cell phone cameras can take us everywhere. It doesn't sound like you actually like that, David, but it does allow us to experience something that we're probably not going to do. Paul, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I can't speak for him because, sadly, he's no longer with us, but I suspect that if Sir Ernest Shackleton was sitting in the studio, he'd be the first person to have taken some kind of satellite device with him to share his triumphs and failures on his expeditions to the South Pole. I think certain explorers are drawn to communicating in real time or as near real time as they possibly can. In Shackleton's day, that meant a US lecture tour and dictating his book to a young scribe during that lecture tour that eventually became South. And some explorers won't. And those who won't still don't now. And I know plenty of friends who go off to do expeditions and nobody's ever going to hear about them.
They're not going to say a word about it.
Nothing.
Let me get TJ from, looks like, Orwigsburg to join us on Radio Times. Hi, TJ. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hello?
Hi there. You're on the air.
Okay. Well, I had a broader statement, possibly question for the gentleman, and I'll take my answer off the air if that's okay.
Sure.
I was just wondering what their thoughts were more about society and how I think, in a way, not just children, but we've all become more protected from our own poor decisions. And what these guys do, as you said, is life and death. There is not really much of a margin for error. And I'm wondering what their thoughts are on how people go through life protected from themselves and then maybe get interested in something that they see on a YouTube video or a real-life feed. And they may go out and try it themselves, not really realizing how close to the edge they actually are because they never fell down off a rock just climbing in the backyard before.
Well, that's
I'll take my answer off the air.
TJ, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm going to toss that first to you, David Roberts.
It somehow reminds me of the fact that when a whole bunch of American kids saw the planes hit the World Trade Towers, some of them said, wow, that's cool, because their life is so YouTubed. They didn't realize what was actually happening, what was so tragic about this. I think we're so surrounded by vicarious experience that it's harder than ever to have a firsthand one.
And Paul, our caller TJ was saying that, and in a sense, we are protected from our own bad decisions, which can get us into trouble.
Yeah, I think TJ's right. I mean, it's a pet peeve of mine, and TJ's hit the nail on the head. And it doesn't just reflect on a young person watching something on YouTube and deciding they want to go and do it. It's that the parents have a responsibility to expose their children to some level of risk early on. And I don't mean a level of risk that could end up in harm, but we are exposed to risk through our entire lives. And if as young people we don't have any idea what risk is, then when it comes to making really important decisions later in our lives, whether it's a physical risk, whether it's a mental risk, whether it's a business risk, we're going to be less able to take it if we've been insulated from risk during our formative years.
And we're almost out of time here. David, you just got back from Utah. Are you planning your next trip?
No, I'm planning to write my next book, which precludes trips.
I'm sorry to hear that, because I know that you'd rather be out there in the great unknown, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And Paul, you're planning a trip across a frozen lake in Siberia.
Yeah, I've got two trips next year. One is to try and write a book and try and express some of what we've talked about today. I'll maybe get a few tips from David off air. But before that, there's a wonderful lake called Lake Baikal. It's more like an inland sea. It's 400 miles long. It's the oldest and deepest lake in the world, over a mile deep. But in winter, the surface freezes enough to support the weight of a person. In fact, it supports the weight of a car at times. And so we're going to undertake a journey from north to south. It's like walking from, I guess, Philadelphia to Montreal, albeit without any restrooms or malls or restaurants en route.
With that lovely Siberian wind blowing across. Yes,
yes, absolutely. And maybe a satellite phone.
That
maybe
was my
a satellite
next question.
Phone, but maybe not any of the blogging or instant reporting.
Right. Well,
it sounds like a great trip, Paul. Yeah, I envy you.
Thank you.
My thanks to both of you so much for joining us today in Radio Time. It's been a great conversation. David Roberts, thank you very much.
Thank you. This was fun and fascinating.
Well, fun and fascinating for us as well. And you can check out an article he wrote recently in the New York Times, Exploits Now Not So Daring. He's also got a new book called Finding Everett Ruiz. And he's been a longtime mountain climber. Paul Deegan, thank you so much as well.
Thank you very much, Marty. It's been a privilege.
It's been a privilege for us as well. He's an explorer and an expedition leader. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find much more about our program, including Facebook and Twitter, the archives, and email. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this hour of Radio Times.